Hey guys, welcome back. We're back at one of our favorite places, Cibo Divino, where Cibo it all Divino. Started for us here on Yellow Tips.
That is correct, many years ago.
So what are you having today?
You're the one who ordered this.
Yeah, I was going to be surprised if you actually knew what it was.
I had to make a pit stop real quick, so it's, surprised
Oak Cliff,
me.
Oak Cliff Brewing, Hefeweizen.
It's good.
And yeah, it's tasty. I'm going back
Light and crisp.
You know, this place, what I love about this place, they have great local beer selection. But they've always had Fire Ant Funeral.
Yeah.
From Texas Ale Project. We used to go to the Texas Ale Project. We haven't been. We need to book another episode over there.
Yeah, we haven't been there in a long time. I thought maybe we'd been told to stay away.
I don't think so.
That's happened before with others.
That has happened before, yeah. But we still like their beer. So. Nevertheless, let me tell you about how this episode started.
Okay.
I got a text from a friend of mine, Ian Mitra, worked for the Texas Tribune for years, and Ian said, "Listen, would you mind if I give your number to this journalist?" She works for The Trace. I'm like, what's The Trace?
I hadn't heard of this before now either.
Yeah, it's The Trace, T-R-A-C-E, thetrace.org. And so I got in touch with this woman, one of the higher-ups there, and I said, hey, is this a new organization? Congratulations. She said,
thanks a lot, but we've been here for more than 10 years.
We've been here for a decade plus, but what's fascinating about this organization, if you know about them, that's fantastic. If you don't, I really encourage you to go to thetrace.org. They have compiled a database nationwide of gun crime and gun violence, and they're building this and continue to build it, but they just released a story about Dallas, Texas, and about a troubling issue here that we're going to talk to the author about in just a moment. Essentially, nationwide, crime rates are going down, violent crime rates are going down. Lawmakers love to brag about that. Rightly, they should, because it's a drop for whatever reason. But youth crime, mm-hmm. is not going down. More kids are getting killed by guns.
And we've heard this before, and I think it bedevils people in law enforcement and the justice system trying to figure out why is this piece of the puzzle so hard to solve?
Right.
Why does it continue to be such a, you know, and it spawns so many tragedies, especially among young people. And that is exactly what this author was able to focus in on in a way that is, I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up, this story that he tells of what has happened here in Dallas, just to one family. And that little microcosm, really, it's not, you don't walk away from it thinking, oh, well, man, that family had a terrible time, really tough for them. It really gives you insight into this whole world that affects a lot of families and a lot of pervasive problems that are going on. And it really gives you that insight that you might not normally think about.
He puts you inside the family. And that's what I read this when I originally got the article. I read it and then I read it again just before the interview here. And I mean, wow.
It's not it's an easy read in the sense that it pulls you in.
You don't want to stop reading it.
You want to continue going. But it's not an easy read in the sense that it's really heart-wrenching,
sure,
what happens. And it's long, and it's so in-depth and so granular. It's like a really, really fascinating book, except the whole time you have to keep telling yourself, man, this actually happened.
And what happened to this one woman named Brittany that he profiles is happening to moms and dads in Fort Worth and Houston and Austin, El Paso, San Antonio, everywhere else.
And no one knows the solution.
No one knows, and that's the problem. But our author today, our guest today, we're lucky to have some. We never had anybody like this on the podcast, ever.
Yeah. He has a pretty impressive resume.
His name's Joe Sexton. He's been spent 25 years. 25 years as a reporter and editor at the New York Times.
On the hard streets of the Big Apple there, yeah.
Then spent 8 years as a reporter and senior editor at ProPublica, the nonprofit investigative newsroom. He's assisted or directed on projects that led to 6 Pulitzer Prizes, 3 Emmy Awards he has. He directed the inspiration for the award-winning Netflix series Unbelievable, the article on that.
Written a book.
And Bob Woodward. Do you see this? Bob Woodward calls him, quote, one of the truly great reporters working today.
And he's spending time with us.
He's on the podcast.
Well, let's do a cheers on that.
But, you know, I mean, how we got him, you know, I owe Ian a beer for connecting us with him here. But the article, I really want you guys to read this because it is a stunning article, thetrace.org. But let's bring this in and bring Joe in to talk about this.
So Joe's latest work is on thetrace.org. This is a harrowing portrait.
It is.
Of this Dallas mom whose family is repeatedly shattered by gun violence.
And very intimate, too. You really get
You're
down
inside the family.
Oh, absolutely.
It's stunning to read here, but it's told alongside the city's struggle to understand why the crime rate is falling in Dallas, like almost every other city across the state, across the country, too. Even as murder rates fall, though, youth violence, crimes with guns, with kids, that is not falling. That's what's troubling.
It is its own conundrum. This was just such a wonderfully written piece. It's 13 pages long. It is a very in-depth read. But I truly felt like I understood the problems better. And I knew this family you followed for so long here. And it really, it was so engaging. It was like a book to read this and really become attached to the characters in this book. Sadly, this is real life, though, and it is just full of tragedy. I'm wondering, when you wrote this, did this change how you thought about gun violence?
No, well, I mean, just a little bit of background, if that helps. So I wrote the piece for a news organization called The Trace, which is, I think, the only independent newsroom in the country completely devoted to covering gun violence. They've been around for well more than a decade. The editor-in-chief is a brilliant young woman, Tally Woodward, Bob Woodward's daughter, and a first-rate journalist in her own right. And they had started to develop a project that was kind of trying to reconcile what you guys had referenced, which is, you know, an overall seeming decline in violent crime in cities and, counties across the country, but a stubborn, you know, and resistance to decline among kids, among juveniles. I'm a pretty veteran in the world of gun violence. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York in the 1960s when I first became a city side reporter at the New York Times in the early 1990s. There were 2,200 homicides a year in New York City. I mean, you just gotta fucking let that number sink in, right? But I have found, you know, in the decades since going out and traveling the country and finding stories in other places, I almost feel in a place like Dallas, which is not a small town, and it's not also New York, and, you know, in the year that the boy in this family, Braylon, was first killed in 2023, you know, there were just under 250 homicides in Dallas that year. So, you know, set against 2,200 in New York, you'd think, well, that's not. And yet somehow in a smaller place, in a smaller town, that number feels, you know, even more both grim and disheartening and sorrowful. And then I just sort of discovered that in 2024, a local paper, the Dallas Morning News, had actually done a project to chronicle and capture every single homicide in the calendar year 2024. This is a practice newsrooms have adopted, you know, across the country. I think the LA Times was the first news organization that they created something called the Homicide Blog. Just as a way of both capturing the scale of the damage, but also, you know, bringing to life in some way, the extraordinary array of losses for young people, old people, people of color, white people, grandparents and grandchildren. The sad state of affairs in America is that there's very little that seems new about gun violence today. It's sort of the national soundtrack. But I do feel that, you know, in a place like Dallas, where the scope of things is smaller, the damage can hit you harder.
So, Joe, this piece on thetrace.org, it opens with this visceral, almost unbearable scene with the mother that you profiled named Brittany in a funeral home. And I want you to tell us about this. How did you decide that was the right entry point? How was that original message conveyed to you from Brittany? You're such a talented writer. I'm just curious how you mined this information and then turned it around for the reader.
Yeah, and I'm a bit of a talker, so I hope I don't take too much of a detour. But I'm a reasonably good storyteller. So, you know, when the Trace decided to do a project on the sort of stubborn problem of juvenile gun deaths and shootings, I had, from the time I was a young reporter in New York, been haunted by a particular story out of Brooklyn, the borough where I grew up in. It was a woman named Frances Davis who had lost 3 sons to gun violence in Brooklyn in the span of a couple of years, and then 2 nephews on top of that. Just even trying to comprehend the size of that tragedy and how a woman, a mom, an aunt could, actually get out of bed the next day and take a step forward had always sort of stayed with me. So I thought, well, could I find an example where a family had suffered multiple losses, but that where they were both, the people who were killed or doing the killing were youngsters, were teenagers or even younger. And, through my expert reporting skills of typing in fucking, something into Google, there had been some local news accounts of what had happened in Northeast Dallas back both at the end of 2023 and early 2024, about how this family had, lost first a 14-year-old son and then a 6-year-old girl, his sister, within the span of literally like 2.5 weeks. And so I thought, well, that might be a powerful example of what I'm looking for. And so I was able to track down Brittany. She had really never spoken at any, at any length or in any detail about what had happened to her family. And when I finally reached her, she said to me, she said, well, I think I'm ready to tell my story. And we had an initial conversation of 90 minutes or so. I was not in Dallas at the time. I would go out later. It all just sort of spilled out. And it's not a story you really have to overthink in terms of how to tell it most powerfully, because the facts alone are just sort of staggering. And she described for me, how her son had been killed. She was, traumatized, grieving, and, preparing to bury him. And she described this, scene of being at the funeral home, dressing her own son for his burial when her phone started to ring. And, she, let it roll the voicemail a couple of times and it kept ringing. And she had brought a friend with her to help her through, the process of dressing her son. And she asked her to pick it up. And it was one of her children from home letting her know that her 6-year-old girl, Elena, had been shot as well in what seemed to be an accident in their home back in Northeast Dallas that Brittany, the mom, had just left 2 hours ago. You don't have to have gone to journalism school or to taking a creative writing class to understand that is, on its face, an extraordinary scene of, you know, of kind of compounded horror for a mom. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, so devastating. And I thought you told it, though, with a lot of humanity, Joe, and a lot of compassion in there. And you really allow the reader to know this mother. She got the call about her six-year-old while she was there at the funeral home dressing her 14-year-old who had been shot to death. And the two of them ended up, as you described it, being buried together in the same casket. And it's just a staggering thing to think about. But if I may, let me read just a little excerpt of what you said here. Brittany, the mom, Brittany remembers thinking that Abraylin's death was, if shattering, comprehensible in the dark calculus of the Dallas streets, boys and guns and bravado and recklessness, even meanness. But Elena was a girl and a homebody. She had been found in a room on the third floor where she played with her dolls. Nothing about her dying there was comprehensible. As a dad of two daughters, I kept on trying to put myself in this mother's position, and it was excruciating to think of what she went through there. You have four kids of your own. You got close to this family. You followed, the tragedy that they experienced. I know as a reporter, you try to insulate your personal life when you're reporting so that you can actually do the job in hard stories like this. But did that affect you in your life as a dad after you went through all this?
It's a conversation I have with my therapist routinely. It's a strange kind of reporting life I built for myself. I've had the both the privilege and the misfortune of covering, tragedies of, enormous range and scope, whether that's 9/11, in my own backyard where 3,000 people died, quadruple homicide in the Bronx. I wrote a book a couple of years ago about a racial killing in Omaha, Nebraska, and the subsequent suicide of the local businessman who'd been charged in the killing of a young African-American boy. My own family often asks me, Joe or Dad or, honey, can you just maybe do a cheerful story every now and again? But I've taken to answering that, but I've always just been drawn to sorrow. I don't know what that says about me, but I think part of it is that even in the worst stories, in the unthinkable kind of array of tragedies, I have always consistently found people of grace and courage and fortitude, and that has always been rewarding in its own peculiar way. And I think in this story too, because it only gets worse, right? I mean, Brittany is there preparing to bury Braylon. She learns her six-year-old Lena is dead now too. She'll subsequently have to face the possibility that her younger boy, Junior, was the one who pulled the trigger killing Lena. And then, 3 months later, her oldest boy, Tim, right, who has an infant child in chemistry with his longtime girlfriend. His girlfriend is then slain along with her mother. And if that weren't enough, the boy implicated and ultimately charged in Braylon's killing was a 14-year-old boy himself, who does little more than a year, in some form of lockup or whatever, is released and is shot dead at age 15. And we're in some kind of Hall of Fame land of gun violence tragedy, as far as I'm concerned. So it's a lot to take in. But I do think that you sort of both explain it to yourself and comfort yourself in some way. My hope is that when this story publishes tomorrow, that Brittany and her mom, Andrea, and her stepdad, Michael, and her remaining children will feel at least that, you know, their story has been seen, right? And that it's not just going to, you know, disappear into the statistics of Dallas homicides in 2023 and 2024. You know, that was one of the curiosities of reporting when I discovered that the Morning News had done this, you know, year-long project in capturing every 2024 homicide in Dallas. But Lena, who was killed in January of 2024, I couldn't find her, you know, on the website and among the dead. And I was like, what the hell is that? I tracked down the reporter who, it, you know, I guess was the sort of central reporter on the project. And she said, well, you know, it was unclear the circumstances of the death and was it an accident, won't have been charged. To me, I still think you actually have to account for that in your project. You know, whether or not the circumstances of the death, you know, are fully known or can be understood, that child deserves to be among, you know, those both counted and honored in a way as part of your project. So I think for the first time now, you know, that homicide that might have just been another number wasn't even worthy of being a number, you know, at least get some kind of public appreciation.
It's striking to think, Joe, how much Brittany has gone through with, you know, three of her own children, and then you know, kind of zoom out with the family in Chicago. You talk about Cabrini Green, the problem, you know, that was up there for years. But here's one striking detail that I didn't realize, and that is law enforcement cannot access juvenile records or share juvenile records. How much of a barrier do you think that is to law enforcement being able to try to prevent some of these, you know, some of this youth gun crime that so many kids are dying from?
Yeah, so in the story, you know, there was a moment a couple of years ago, the police chief in Dallas at the time was a guy named Eddie Garcia. He actually was the first Latino police chief in Dallas's history. And I guess when he was preparing for the job or wanting to be selected or elected, he worked with a couple of academics to put together, you know, a crime-fighting plan for how you could knock down violent crime.
Yeah, we actually had him on this podcast to talk about that.
In that year. Yeah. And, yeah, he talked about the data-driven model.
Right. And, you know, so it had a couple of elements to it. And one was, you know, you could use your data to figure out where the hotspots were around and then, you know, assign your patrol officers and other, you know, resources, you know, in a more strategic way. There was trying to understand what they called the physical networks of crime in Dallas, which I think means, you know, whether there was a particular troubled housing project also adjacent to, you know, a mini market over here and that there was, you know, then you could really kind of trace, you know, the interactions and the variety of forces at work in the neighborhood where crime was happening. And then the third was you could identify really repeat offenders. And for adults, you know, they were able to, you know, just sort of search records broadly, identify people with, you know, long, you know, rap sheets and records, and go to them and try and make a deal with them to say, look, you know, you can get locked up for the rest of your life, or you can, you know, attempt to make a change, and we're going to offer you that possibility. But when it came to young people, and it took me a while to really understand the statutory limitations here, and I think I've got it right, but it was explained to me by Mike Smith, who was one of the academics who had worked with Eddie Garcia. And it is that, like, if you have a juvenile who's been arrested or whatever, you can go as law enforcement, prosecutor, the police, and find out what is that kid's, you know, does he have prior records or whatever. But what you can't do is kind of take a broad look, trying to identify as many kids as you can with, you know, repeat offenses, whatever, and then try to, you know, target them. And, you know, I found it kind of remarkable. I don't know necessarily how utterly distinctive it is for Dallas, but I think Smith and others believe that that has limited their ability to sort of, you know, knock down the numbers concerning violent crime among young people in Dallas.
Yeah, you know, when we spoke with former Chief Garcia in 2023, and he told us about this data-driven model where they were trying to sort of swarm these hot spots where crime was happening a lot, and also trying to have officers be in the community day after day after day so that they don't just show up after, you know, tragedy strikes. And they were really upbeat about this program, thinking this is a real solution. This is really going to make a dent. You spoke with this expert, though, in academia, who helped them to develop this model. And here we are, 2026 now. That was 2023. They're still sort of sorting through this to figure out, what about that worked? What about that didn't work? Did it work? Didn't it work? They're still trying to figure that out.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of put it in, you know, the Dallas' experience and the broader national experience, which is, you know, for all of the work that has gone, all the resources, all the scholarship, and, you know, all the street level efforts, truly understanding what drives, you know, increases or decreases in violent crime in America has been a really elusive sort of ambition. And, you know, to his great credit, Mike Smith, who's a professor at the University of Texas at San Antonio and who had worked on the Dallas crime fighting plan, you know, he told me, he said, look, I'm an expert. And if I'm being totally honest, I can tell you, you know, here's cause and here's effect. You know, and it has often become, whether it's in a big city like New York or medium-sized city like Dallas or in smaller cities across America, it's often become, as everything else has in America, a politicized issue, right? What really accounts for it? Well, some people will say, you know, it's really smarter, more sophisticated policing. Other people will say, yeah, it's actually the consequence of mass incarceration. You know, if you lock up enough people, you're going to knock down crime. But, you know, are you prepared to have your, you know, prison population soar and, you know, communities robbed of their young men and women? So there are no, you know, really, I think, truly reliable numbers. And the country's going to have its hands full now in a good way in that, you know, the national murder rate today or in the last year in 2025 is at the lowest level it's been in more than 100 years. Something absolutely worth celebrating, right? And being grateful for. But still going to be, I think, in many ways, inscrutable as to exactly what accounts for that.
Yeah. You know? To your point there, though, that's one of the things that I found enlightening about this article and that I think might be enlightening for a lot of folks. Obviously, guns are a big part of this, but you start reading through this and you realize it's, you know, it's guns, it's culture, drugs, gangs, socioeconomics, race, age, gender, drugs, family dynamics, geography even, where you live in a city. Did it leave you, I mean, that seems overwhelming when you think of all of these factors that go into this. Did it leave you feeling more hopeless about this problem?
Oh, no. I'm a pretty sturdy optimist about life in general.
Are you really, after all you've covered?
Absolutely, yeah. People find that surprising. I'm also an optimist about the future of journalism. People think I'm fucking crazy thinking that as well. You know, right? I mean, just the, it is difficult to know how to feel exactly if these two things can be true, right? One, in 2025, we had the lowest murder rate nationally in more than 100 years. At the same time, right? And the Trace does a great job of collecting these statistics, right? 13 million guns sold, 400 mass shootings, 100 people shot every day of every week of every month, 2,000 gun suicides a month, 1,200 children slain by gunfire in America in 2025. So it's hard, right? How is one to feel, right? One, wow, we're at record low levels. And two, oh my God, the slaughter is extraordinary and unacceptable. I think, at least it's been my, and I'm getting old, man. I'll be 67 in July, man. I'm about to hang it up. But the, you tell stories and you hope they matter. And if they don't affect extraordinary change, maybe they accomplish something more modest, but still meaningful, say for a family like Brittany Ross's.
Well, let me ask you this then, as Jason would say, to put a finer point on it here, but you mentioned that Mike Smith, the experts don't even really have a full grasp on this. The answer is elusive and always has been. But what does your gut tell you after all this reporting? Going way back to the mom and there in the boroughs, and then coming down here to Dallas. What does your gut tell you about how to protect kids from gun violence?
Oh, I don't know. I'm a reporter. I'm not a criminologist. I won't pretend to have a responsible answer to that question. I was struck by one little thing that that maybe speaks to your curiosity on that point. So in talking with Mike Smith and the professor at UT San Antonio, and we were talking about what has your data now that you've made this investment? And it was like millions of dollars a year to implement this crime fighting strategy. What has worked and what hasn't? And, he was, again, honest enough to say, well, there's some things that show that our hotspot policing has had a real effect or whatever. But for youth or whatever, he said, you know what? The best thing that he's found in terms of is summer jobs. And I was like, wow, I fucking get it. And it seems extraordinarily simple and maybe overly simple. But kids having a summer job, which ought not to be a somehow unconquerable, thing to pull off and to provide. I was just a kind of dead simple idea that I thought like, yeah, fucking A.
Yeah. It's not a bad idea at all.
It's so simple, it's hard.
Are there, and I kind of know the answer to this, but you've covered so much of it. Based on this story and your reporting, are there any policy changes that could be made at a local level, at a state level, at a national level to help address this at all?
I don't know. I mean, I don't want to take the journalist cop-out thing, right? I'm a finder of facts. I'm not a fashioner of answers.
Yeah, but did any family member, did Brittany or anybody tell you, listen, we really need, lawmakers to do X, Y, or Z to get a handle on this?
Well, look, I mean, the question of guns in America, right? And guns are at the heart of all violent crime in America. That really matters, is a tortured political issue that, as a country, I think it's safe to say we have utterly failed in actually meaningfully addressing. But my pitch here, you know, and purpose in doing the story was not to make a case for greater gun control or lesser gun control, whatever. It is really just, you know, I think if you imagine that there ought to be policy changes, right, whatever they may be, from whatever side of the political aisle you're on, you know, you're going to have to be motivated to act, right? You're going to have to, and sometimes, you know, the role of a reporter in motivating or provoking, you know, politicians and lawmakers into action is to tell a story like this, right? You go ahead, Mr. State Senator or Mrs. State Senator or whatever, you read this fucking story and you tell me, can't we do something better here? Really? Not? So I think that's our role. And it's, you know, it can often be a limited and frustrating one, but, you know.
No, it's spot on.
And I think for people who think that, well, that's something that happens over there in that part of town, yes, there are parts of town, obviously, you know, the police wouldn't have done the swarming thing if that weren't the case. But just here in Dallas, just last year, they had almost 13,000 calls around the city for random gunfire. 13,000 for random gunfire. So clearly, you know, this is something that can affect anybody in any neighborhood at any time. You touched on this a little bit, but I'll press on it a little bit more. There are going to be people, especially here in Texas, where there are a lot of conservative people, who will hear all of this. They'll hear of the Trace and its mission to focus on gun crimes and gun violence, and might immediately just think, this is liberals for gun control, I'm tuning out. What's your thought about folks who might do that? Or what would you say to them?
God help you. I don't know. We're at a really, you know, broken moment in our national experiment here. You know, in the face of what seems like, you know, just irremediable, you know, discord and anger and mistrust and conspiracy theorizing, you know, the biggest mistake somebody like I could make is to actually let it get you down. Because then you know, then the people who don't, you know, then they win. And by they, I mean people who are so sworn to their positions on the left or the right that, you know, it's unthinkable that you might actually work together to solve something as significant and serious as this. You know, I think at a place like the Trace, right? You could say the Trace been here for, I don't know, 10, 15 years, whatever, exclusively covering gun violence. You know, what has it amounted to? Well, it's amounted to a, you know, a kind of act of national testimony. You know, you keep testifying to it because you believe it's important and consequential, and you hope for the best.
Joe, last thing I was going to ask you about here, I want to read.
And then, you know, you guys are telling me we're going to be drinking beer. That's what I would do next, right?
Hopelessness, you told me you were a cheap date, man. You said you were a cheap date and didn't drink beer, so.
The greatest piece of journalism I might have ever written was a defense of Bud Light in the middle of its, when there was this whole political storm about, you know, Bud Light and transgender and you know, I stood up for Bud Light. That's where, you know, that's where my $1.75 is going, the bar.
That's Big J right there, huh? Hey, let me end with this. Your writing, your words are just, you know, hit me in a number of ways, but One line you said, sorrow stalks Brittany, the Dallas mom here, and despair can drop on her like a heavy blanket. I'm just curious, you know, as you spoke with her over the weeks, what's next for her now, considering how much tragedy she's been through?
Well, you know, she got out of Dallas.
She moved to Mesquite, you said, right?
You know, correct. And, you know, the story ends with by invoking a kind of, I thought, quite fascinating recent kind of bit of public polling, which was kind of measuring how many people who, you know, whatever it is about America they're currently frustrated with or exasperated by or just dead sick of, they're leaving the country, right? And in not insubstantial numbers. And the greatest number of people leaving the country for those reasons are women and moms. And the single greatest reason for their desire to get out of America is their fear for the safety of their children. Brittany Ross is not, you know, equipped to get on a plane and, you know, whatever, fly to Dublin and, you know, buy a house in the Irish countryside and feel safe. But she got out of Dallas. She's in Mesquite. She's there with Tim, her oldest boy, and his child, and the rest of her three children. And, you know, you think like, okay, maybe that's a breakthrough for Brittany too, right? And I went out and saw her there and sat with her at her dining room table. And we were, you know, finishing the conversation and she was like, oh yeah, well, there was a kid shot dead over at the school where Junior is going now, in Mesquite. And so, you know, maybe somehow she will get on that flight to Dublin because maybe Mesquite isn't far enough or safe enough, which is, you know.
Well, you can read Joe Sexton's piece right now at thetrace.org. It is definitely recommended reading. What a story that you've told here. And Joe, I'll finish with this. You mentioned what you hope the family gets out of this. What do you hope the average reader who goes and reads this story gets from it?
I don't know, maybe a sleepless night, you know? If out of that, you know, troubled restlessness or whatever, they decide like, I'm going to do an act of, you know, goodness and decency tomorrow, or I'm going to go, you know, sign up at the local, you know, youth violence prevention program, you know, that would be a great outcome.
Yeah, get involved. Sometimes a sleepless night is the best thing for us to kind of jar us, you know, on topics like these.
Joe, congrats on all your successes on putting this piece together, too. Again, it's at thetrace.org where you can find Joe's latest work. Early happy birthday to you as well, man, coming up in July here. Go ahead.
Well, I've got four daughters and I got to marry off the second of the four in July before I celebrate my birthday.
Oh.
So let's see if I make it to my birthday.
Well, good stuff.
A lot going on.
Very grateful for you guys having me. I appreciate your interest and your care. And the thoughtfulness you brought to reading the story and allowing me to talk a bit about it. And, you know, and I get on my bucket list, I can check it off. I've been on Yolitics podcast. Who the fuck is that?
Add that to the end of that impressive resume, man.
Put that on there, man, right below the Pulitzer.
Please,
right?
Please Yolitics. Put us on there. Joe, thank you so much. The pleasure has been ours.
All right, take care. Have a Bud Light on me.